Because of limitations of time, I want to jump ahead to this next main heading, the theme of the course. And regrettably, I think that there will be some students who will take great exception, maybe offense, at the theme. And that is that the division of labor and its benefits depends on the institutions of capitalism. That in order to have a division of labor society, a first world economy, you actually do require a capitalist economic system that will not occur under socialism. And let me proceed immediately to explain what I mean by capitalism. And the way I put it right here is a political economic system based on private ownership of the means of production. That's pretty generally recognized that that's an essential feature, defining feature of capitalism. But also, I add, and characterized by the pursuit of material self-interest under freedom. That's a significant elaboration. Now, the pursuit of material self-interest, I don't think requires immediate elaboration, but the word freedom does. And so let me tell you that what I mean by freedom is the absence of the initiation of physical force. When someone is free, what he is free of or free from specifically is the initiation of physical force by other people, in particular and above all by his country's government. If you live in a free country, you're free from the initiation of physical force by the country's government. That's what it means to be free, to be free from aggression by the government. Now, what do I mean by physical force and its initiation? Physical force means physically doing something to or with the person or the property of another against his will. So, pointing a gun at someone, shooting him, killing him, locking him up, tying him up, taking away his property, all of these things against his will, that is the use of physical force. And the concept also includes fraud. If I show up at your front door saying I'm here to take your television set to repair it, but I'm really there to take it to sell it, my taking it to sell is taking your set against your will. I'm stealing the set. Fraud is a subcategory of the forcible taking of another's property. It's taking his property against his actual informed will. The initiation of force simply means starting the use of force. The simplest distinction is a bank robber comes in, pulls a gun on the teller, he's initiating the force. The bank guard, who then pulls his gun to stop the robber, he is using force in defense or retaliation. Freedom is violated by the initiation of physical force. It's upheld by the use of force in defense or retaliation. Now, I referred in point C to freedom and the necessity of limited government. A government represents the organized use of force, basically in defense and retaliation. The fundamental necessity of a government is to have an organized defense against the initiation of physical force, subject to objective controls. All governments prohibit such acts as murder, assault, robbery, theft. The primary function of government is to protect the citizens against the initiation of force by other citizens. And it does so in making such acts illegal. So to the extent you have a government that prohibits things like murder and is effective in catching murderers and deterring them, Well, such a government is securing your freedom from murder. If you had a government doing its job, the government responding to initiations of force, using its force in defense and retaliation, to the extent the government succeeded, we would be free from the threat of private initiation of force. The government would secure our freedom vis-a-vis other private citizens. But how does the government do this? How does the government combat common criminals? It itself uses force. If you notice, the police are armed. Even in Britain, when they were not carrying sidearms, they still had billy clubs. And if they needed sidearms, they could easily obtain them. Just think, what is it that makes people obey any law?
The fear of punishment.
The fear of punishment, and what does that rest on? It's force. It's force. Anytime the government imposes a law or a ruling, edict, decree, whatever, it's not an advisory opinion. It's saying, you damn well better comply with this or else. What's the or else? There'll be some armed officer coming to haul you away or impose a fine. And if you were to resist, what then happens?
Force would be applied.
And then there's greater force. Then they summon a SWAT team. Ultimately, you are compelled to obey the law, really, in the last analysis, by the threat of being killed if you don't. So all laws, everything the government does, rests on the threat of force. Now that's actually necessary and desirable insofar as what the government is prohibiting is itself initiations of force. To the extent the government says no one shall commit murder, robbery, fraud, rape, whatever, and it's backing it up by the threat of force, then the government can succeed in minimizing such things and in really securing freedom. But because the government is an agency that uses force, it itself is potentially a tremendous threat to freedom. Because what happens to the extent the government uses its force, not in defense or retaliation, but itself initiates the use of force, as many, many governments have done? And suppose the government says it shall be illegal to be Jewish, or illegal to be black, or if you are, you suffer various severe disabilities. Well, in that case, the government itself is violating freedom. Now, the great genius of the founding fathers of the United States is they recognized the nature of government and that it was potentially very, very hazardous to your health. You know, on all packs of cigarettes, we have a warning, smoking is hazardous to your health, and I'm sure it is. But there is actually a greater hazard than smoking and other such things, too much sugar or chocolate or whatever, and that is uncontrolled government. Because what can the government do if it's out of control? So just think, what is the armament of the worst criminal gang? How much arms do the Bloods and the Crips have available? Or the Mafia? Or the Purple Gang or whatever? Or Jesse James? They have revolvers. They have some rifles. Now they may have some submachine guns. Maybe they could get a few mortars. What's any modern government got? They have an army, tanks, artillery, and many of them have rockets with atomic and hydrogen bombs. Now, who is the greater potential threat? Governments. And where would you rather have taken your chances, with the Capone mob or the Gestapo? the Purple Gang or the KGB. Governments are potentially the greatest threat to freedom, because they have open lines of communication, they have vastly greater concentrations of power. And so what the founding fathers and a line of political philosophers before them, above all John Locke, what they recognized was that in order to secure freedom, what you need is limited government. The government has to be controlled. It's a potential vicious beast that needs to be kept within a cage and shackled so that it cannot get out and run wild doing damage. And to achieve that, they constructed the United States government based on a division of powers, a system of checks and balances. We have three distinct branches of government, each one supposedly watching the other two and limiting their powers. And we have a division between the state and federal governments with distinct powers. And then we have a constitution and Bill of Rights. All of these are means of limiting and controlling the powers of the government so that the government would be essentially limited to acting against common criminals, protecting the citizens from the initiation of force, and not itself initiating force. Now, if you had that, if we have a situation where the government, in effect, sits on the criminals, makes life miserable for the citizens who initiate the use of force, who are defining themselves thereby as criminals, if the government can minimize them, and at the same time it does not initiate force because it's restrained by a constitution, Bill of Rights, division of powers, and all the rest of it, then you have a free country. Then the individual citizen does not have to worry about being robbed, raped, murdered, or whatever. That's not a major concern of life. It's something off in the remote background. And he does not have to fear his own government. He does not have to live in dread of getting an audit notice from the IRS, for example, or of being told that he's out of compliance with God knows what regulations. Then you have a free country. Yes?
In your definition of the primary factor that keeps the infrastructure in place, is the fear of force, that's the primary factor that people stay in place. Where, how do you factor morality and ideological codes?
No, I didn't say that the fear of force is the primary factor that makes the system work or society run. I just said that freedom is the absence of the initiation of physical force, and moral convictions certainly operate with this. You need a society in which most people are ready to avoid, as far as they're aware, initiating force, and to condemn those who do. Now, if you had a society where the dominant moral idea was that it's okay to initiate the use of force, then there'd be nothing that could stop it.
Isn't that in a way what we're facing right now?
Well, we are facing a situation in which very few people are aware of the distinction between the initiation of force and the use of force in defense or retaliation, in which people think there are no limits to government power. Anytime many, many people want something, they think it's perfectly fine to try to achieve it through passing some law without realizing that in doing so they can be forcing other people to act against their will. See, anytime you have a group that wants to get money from the government, and we have no shortage of such groups, well, how will the government collect that money? Doesn't it always reduce to some people want the government to threaten some of their fellow citizens with jail unless they support that first group? And we have people who believe they're entitled to all kinds of things from the government, and they don't stop to ask the question, who will pay for this and what will make them pay for it?
Well,
So we do have major problems with people with their moral political ideas being incompatible with freedom. But to the extent that we would have freedom, then people are in a position to set about achieving their material self-interest. And let me jump ahead to point three here. Hopefully we'll come back and touch on point two. I refer it to capitalism, its nature and origin. Well, the basic thing is private ownership of the means of production and characterized by the pursuit of material self-interest under freedom. Well, just think, if you have freedom, as I've tried to explain it, where what you're free of is the initiation of physical force. There's a government, there's a police force, there are courts with judges, there are jails. But essentially the only things that are illegal are acts such as murder, robbery, rape, fraud. Acts entailing the initiation of physical force. And the government is effective in combating them. It doesn't have to catch every last criminal, but it catches a very substantial number. They're put out of circulation. That serves as a deterrent to others who might be tempted to go along the same path. So if the government does that and succeeds, then the average citizen doesn't have to be greatly concerned with being the victim of crime. The government is making him free of depredations by criminals. And if at the same time the government is limited to that, that's all it's doing, then the citizen doesn't have to be afraid of the government either. Well, then what are you able to do if you don't have to worry about being the victim of physical force, either by your neighbors or by the government? But you yourself, of course, are prohibited from initiating force. And now here you are, you would like to pursue your material well-being. You want to make your life materially better. Well, what sorts of things will you have to do? What will define the limits of your action and the character of your action? Yes.
I mean, from what I read, it was basically your material freedom is if you want a car. If you don't have a car, you want a car. If you have one car, you go for two cars.
All right.
Or an airplane or a boat. Or
okay.
Increasing to your material wealth.
Okay. And how would you obtain that? How are you attempting to obtain? You're interested in a higher standard of living, aren't you? How are you going about doing that? Yes?
You're selling your skills to the highest bidder.
You're selling your skills to the highest bidder, and at the same time, you're attempting to augment your skills, right? Presumably that's why you're in an MBA program. You want to augment your skills. You want to make yourself more marketable and earn a higher income by doing that. Now, what about the companies that you're working for? How are they, by and large, attempting to improve their profitability?
Getting the greatest return on investment.
Well, how are they attempting to do that? They want the greatest return on investment. They'd like to have a greater return than they do now. Or they want to maintain if they have a good return, they want to maintain it in the face of competition. So what sorts of things do they have to do? They have to improve their productivity. They have to come up with improved products or lower cost methods of producing the products they are producing. They have to anticipate changes in consumer demand and have the things that consumers want when they want them. So they're attempting to gear their activities. They're attempting to do things that will induce customers voluntarily to buy from them on a larger scale, or to cut their costs of production. They're attempting to improve to offer things in the market that more people want or will be willing to pay higher prices for, and at the same time to improve their efficiency, produce at lower costs. And to the extent they succeed in doing that, they can earn a greater income. Well, now, to the extent they do that, what's the effect on the people they're dealing with? See, we can see that to the extent you succeed, that's very good for you. But if you're succeeding by offering a better product in the market, what's the effect on the buyers of the product? They're receiving a better product. If you're producing more efficiently at a lower cost, well, ultimately, what's going to be the effect on the price that the buyers will pay? That will go down. Now, you see, you have to realize that when firms introduce improvements and they increase their own profits, almost always they have competitors. And even if they didn't have any existing competitors, if some lines of business become exceptionally profitable, as soon as others get wind of this, they'll try to duplicate it. A recent example from all the commercials we see, first there's Viagra, then there's, what's the next one, Levitra, and then there's a third one, maybe a fourth one. So what's the effect of that on the profits of Viagra when it gets this pile of competitors? It goes down. Or more importantly, here's Intel. They come out years ago with an 8286 chip, and that's the hottest thing in the market, circa 1984, 1985. But how long does the 8286 chip remain the hottest thing in the market? Not very long. Others are doing it. Then what does Intel have to do? Come out with the 8386. And people are cutting their costs. Back in the 19th century at some point, I think Carnegie Steel may have introduced the Bessemer process in the United States steel industry. And that represented a significant cost-saving improvement. Well, what happened when steel generally came to be produced by that more advanced method? Then the price of steel reflected the lower cost. And then to make money through efficiency, you had to have greater efficiencies. So anytime anyone is introducing improvements, his motive is to improve his own profits. But at the same time, he has to offer better products to the buyers, more efficient methods of production, which will ultimately be passed on to the buyers. So what's the effect of that profit seeking on the general standard of living? It's driving it forward. That's how the standard of living goes up. Just think of why was practically anything that we take for granted invented and then improved in all the ways it was improved. It's the profit motive. The profit motive leads to newer, better products and more efficient methods of producing whatever exists. And that's what's continually raising the standard of living. Now, you see, this is the pursuit of self-interest under freedom. When you're attempting to earn more money, and the one thing you're not allowed to do is initiate the use of force, and the only way you can then make more money is with the voluntary cooperation of the people you deal with. That means, in order for you to make more money, you have to benefit the buyers of your products, and you have to produce them more efficiently. And you have to benefit everyone who's dealing with you. Just think, if you cannot resort to force or fraud against people, how do you get them to deal with you? Pardon me?
Make it a benefit.
You have to make it a benefit to them. In order for you to benefit in your dealings, if you have to deal with people voluntarily, you have to see to it that they benefit. And this is one of the enormously important insights of Adam Smith back in the 18th century. He said, the nature of every bargain is that in order for me to benefit, I have to see to it that you also benefit. Both parties in a freely conducted bargain benefit. There's a harmony of self-interest. This is one of the tremendous insights of Smith and the classical economists, that the self-interests of people could be harmonious. Now, that is only true provided they cannot resort to physical force against one another, that they have to deal with one another on a voluntary basis. If people are to deal with one another voluntarily, it has to be on the basis of mutual benefit. And then you have self-interest acting as this enormously powerful engine of progress. See, it makes all the difference whether or not you can resort to force. If you can't, if you cannot resort to force, if that's the one thing you can't do, but you do wish to promote your self-interest, you do want to serve your material self-interest, well, what do you have to do? You have to produce benefits. You have to produce better, more efficient products. Then you do serve your self-interest by doing that, but at the same time, what are you doing to the self-interest of those who deal with you? They're promoting it as well. This is what makes the profit motive the tremendous engine of progress that it is. But it's a life and death difference whether or not you can promote your self-interest by force or are prohibited from doing that. See, we're talking, when we talk of the profit motive and capitalism in positive, glowing terms even, it's always on the understanding that you are prohibited from using physical force. You're prohibited from initiating force. That means you have to promote your self-interest by introducing improvements, by serving the self-interest of those you deal with at the same time. Now, if you remove this constraint on force, then all bets are off. And there are lots of people who try to promote their self-interest by using force. And what's a good classic illustration? The protection racket. The mafia can stand as a good representation of the attempt to promote self-interest by force. They sell protection. They have stick-ups. Criminal activity in general. A bank robber wants to get a lot of loot, but how does he do it? He goes and he robs the bank. Now, that's not promoting anybody's self-interest. Now, unfortunately, there's tremendous confusion. Many, many people, when they think of self-interest, when they think of the profit motive, greed, whatever, they're not making any distinction between the attempt to serve your self-interest in peaceful, voluntary trade or through force. They're not seeing the distinction. And they think there really is no such distinction. And many, many people unfortunately hold what you can describe as a mafioso view of self-interest. They think the way you serve self-interest is you go and rob banks, have a protection racket, engage in con games, whatever. That's their concept of self-interest. And any time they hear people are pursuing their self-interest, they want to make the greatest possible profits, well, they think we're talking about mafioso. And I think this mindset explains a tremendous part of the hostility to business and profits. People are thinking of business as some kind of mafioso. Now, things can be very, very confused. It's possible for any given individual at one time or another to act in an improper way. You might have someone who for 99% of his career is pursuing his self-interest strictly through voluntary trade, mutual benefit, but there could be 1% where he breaches that. And maybe that, nowadays, maybe that's true to some degree of everybody. And what makes it particularly confusing is the kinds of laws that can be passed. Suppose, for example, you have a software company or computer company, and its regular normal operations are it's introducing better software or more powerful computers or whatever. It's functioning normally in a proper, highly productive way. But there might be some occasion that comes up. They decide to make generous political contributions to get some law passed or some rider tacked onto a law that will prohibit other people from competing with them. Let's take the American steel industry. I'm sure almost all of the time, day in and day out, the American steel industry is trying to make profit by producing high-quality steel, even better steel than they are producing, and to do it more efficiently than they are. But sometimes they encounter some competition that they feel they can't meet, like foreign steel, and then they make generous political contributions and they'll get a special tariff prohibition enacted against their foreign competitors. Well, what stops the foreign competitors from selling in the face of the added tariff burden?
They have to raise their prices.
Well, what is it that compels them to pay the higher tariff? Suppose we have Nippon Steel, let's say, and it's sending its steel over in freighters. What would happen if the freighters dock and the customs agents are there and the people on the vessel say, oh, we're just unloading our steel, we're not paying the higher tariff? Then they'd be forced. The Coast Guard would probably be out with a gunboat or whatever. They would have to pay. They don't have a choice. They would be forced to act in violation of the law. The law represents force. But now just think, is sending your goods to some country, is that an act of force? Are you initiating force when you send your goods somewhere? No, but if you're stopped, there's an initiation of force. The initiation is your being stopped. Now, we have business firms. Normally, they're engaged in pursuing profit by perfectly proper, positive means. But time and again, they turn to the government for such a thing as a tariff, a special subsidy, maybe launching some legal action against a competitor. And when they do that, then they're pursuing their self-interest along the lines of the people who are using brass knuckles. So it becomes very, very mixed. Now, while it may be mixed in practice, while it's entirely possible that every single business in the country today is guilty of some kind of attempt to benefit from the initiation of force, analytically, we can still make a very sharp, clear distinction. And we can say that this kind of business activity is very positive and proper, raising the standard of living of everyone. And then there are other activities which are working the opposite way. And the ultimate application would be to minimize or totally eliminate the instances in which businesses can be responsible or feel they need to be responsible for initiating force, and instead let them pursue their profit motive strictly by introducing better products, more efficient methods of production. Now, if to the extent that you have the profit motive and pursuit of self-interest operating under freedom, to the extent that the initiation of force is prohibited and minimized, well, then you have this incredibly powerful positive engine of progress. And that's essentially what we established with the founding of the United States, at least for the white male population. There was greater freedom than at any previous time in history. Now just project, what would people do, say starting back around 1790, a year after the Constitution was enacted, 2 years after. Here you are, you're living in New England or the Middle Atlantic states, somewhere more or less on the eastern seaboard, and you want to improve your material well-being. Well, what would be a good way for many people to do that at that time? Move west. Lay claim to land that is essentially just uninhabited. No one has made any fixed claims to it. It's largely empty forest. And so they start clearing trees, pulling out stumps and roots, and establishing farms. They're moving west, and they're establishing private property in land. They're appropriating land from nature. Their pursuit of self-interest lay in the appropriation of land from nature. Now, if they're free, and if at the same time they think long range, they recognize themselves as effective causal agents, and some of this relates back to point two, the philosophical foundations of capitalism and economic activity. If people perceive themselves as capable of achieving effects, long-term effects, and they're free, they don't have to worry about their neighbors confiscating their land, they don't have to worry about the government confiscating it, and they want to benefit themselves, and they think long range, then they start doing things in the present that will improve their productivity 10, 20, 30 years in the future. That's why these farmers would clear the land, pull out the rocks, the stumps, drain land, irrigate it, one thing and another. They're taking action in the present to benefit themselves in a fairly distant future. And that is an important, simple form of saving and capital accumulation. They labor in the present to benefit in the future. And then that carries over. Why do people start saving in their 20s and 30s to provide for themselves in their 60s and 70s? Well, what are the preconditions of doing that? Pardon me? You have to trust that that you will own what you're saving, that it won't be seized from you, you will not be robbed by envious neighbors, and the government will not confiscate you. And if people have that conviction, and at the same time they do think long range, their mentality, the culture that they live in, favors long range thinking, being aware of the future and the present, well, then acting for your material self-interest means you save and invest. And that's a major precondition of economic progress and prosperity. Now, we can threaten that today. If anyone is saving, let's say, $1,000 in a given year, if that $1,000 is going into an investment that will pay a certain number of dollars. Suppose you're going to put up $1,000, you're saving $1,000 buying some type of bond or other fixed income security. Well, what do you think is going to be the buying power of $1,000 in 30 years? Almost certainly much less. The only question is, how much less? Well, how does such a situation affect the extent to which people will save and provide for the future, the extent to which they can serve their self-interest by saving and providing for the future if the buying power of money cannot be assumed? if all you can assume is that it'll be less. But how much less? Well, to the extent we have a monetary system where people cannot trust the buying power, how must that affect saving and serving your self-interest by means of saving? It has to undermine it. It's a very serious impairment. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk and discussion how low the rate of savings is. And I think a very, very major reason is that we have a monetary unit whose buying power you can't trust. And if you're attempting to save in any form that will come back as a fixed number of dollars, well, you really have no idea what that's going to be worth or how important that will be, how valuable it will be. Now, if we wanted people to be able to serve their self-interest by saving and providing for the future and doing so in terms of contractually fixed numbers of dollars, what would we have to do about the monetary unit? Well, we'd have to have a monetary unit whose buying power would not perpetually shrink. We'd have to have a different kind of monetary unit than we now do. Now, the monetary unit that we have today, I assume you're all familiar with the idea that the value of anything depends on its scarcity or lack of scarcity, its scarcity or abundance. What limits the supply of paper dollars? They can be printed or just manufactured by entries on the books. Someone can hit some computer keys and money can come into being in immense quantities. Well, what do you think the ability to create money without limit, what effect must that have on the prospective buying power of money? It undercuts it. It threatens it. Now, if you wanted to have a monetary unit that people could trust, you would have to have a monetary unit whose quantity could not be arbitrarily increased. You'd have to have a monetary unit that could be increased only with very considerable difficulty. That would be a monetary unit whose buying power could be trusted. Any notion of possible candidates?
Diamonds, gold.
Gold is the traditional monetary unit, and the main reason for the advantages of gold is that governments have never mastered the art of alchemy, and so they can't destroy the value of gold. But they can easily destroy the value of paper that they can create without limit. Well, that's a whole other major discussion. But notice the main point is that if people are left to pursue their self-interest under the one fundamental constraint that they can't do so by means of initiating force, then there are all kinds of ways to pursue your self-interest that are positive and profoundly beneficial. Introducing new and improved products, more efficient methods of production, and before that, appropriating land and natural resources from nature, saving and providing for the future. In fact, the totality of our economic development, I think, can be understood in terms of the principle of individuals pursuing their peaceful self-interest. That's what led to the settlement of the West. That's why people moved west, established farms. Why did merchants follow the farmers and open stores to supply them? That was profitable for them. That's how they served their self-interest. Why did other people begin stagecoach lines, then barge lines, and later on railroads, and still later open gas stations, produce automobiles? Why all of these improvements in the means of transportation? What led people to carry them out, to look for them and implement them? Their desire to serve their self-interest. That's the profit motive for them. Why did other people build factories and invent the equipment that went into them and improve the equipment and the products they'd be producing. What motivated them? The profit motive, again. Why did other people who are born on farms decide that they'd be better off working in towns and cities and in the new factories that were being built rather than staying on the farms? Well, that was their self-interest. What led little insignificant towns to grow into major cities? How did that happen? Do you think there were government bureaus that said, here's Fort Detroit, has a couple of hundred people, we need to have a big city there, and so we'll round up the serfs and put them in Detroit? How do you think all of the different cities grew? It was individuals, one at a time, making decisions. This was the best place for me to be at the time. The reason for practically everything occurring was the pursuit of material self-interest under freedom. And literally, in the space of about 100 years, from 1776 to 1876, it led to the development of the North American continent. And of course, it's gone on ever since. And this is the great, powerful engine, material self-interest. And I think we can see it at work very powerfully, despite a lot of impediments and a lot of wrongful type pursuit of self-interest going on in China today. They were getting nowhere under the Mao Zedong regime, but they finally recognized that what they needed to do was unleash material self-interest, and to a very, very substantial degree, by no means completely, I'm sure with more negatives mixed in than we have here, they've succeeded in very, very substantial economic development. But that's the secret, turning people free to pursue their material self-interest. Now, as I say, many, many people have great difficulty in distinguishing between the pursuit of material self-interest by positive, productive means and brass knuckles. And again and again, they think there's no distinction. And that's the most fateful error that could be made, I think, in economics. Because if you believe that the way self-interest is achieved is through brass knuckles, well, what happens to the extent that people are out attempting to achieve their self-interest that way? In effect, through robbery. It undermines the system. Now just notice, any time there's a robbery, whatever the robber gains, the victim must lose, right? There's no net gain, obviously. But now, if robbery becomes a common, large-scale phenomenon, how does that affect what the potential victims produce? How much are people going to produce if they know the likelihood is that when they produced it, they'll be robbed? They won't produce it. So the consequence of robbery as a widespread social phenomenon is that it actually works against the general self-interest. Not only is it the case that what the robbers gain, the victims equivalently lose, but there is that much less to be robbed. Now, this is why the feudal era was so miserably poor. Under feudalism, each feudal principality was attempting to live by plundering its neighbors. Now, when everyone is attempting to live by plundering everybody else, how much is there to plunder? There's just not all that much to plunder. So that becomes a very stupid, self-defeating policy. No one can succeed in those conditions. And this is why many writers have said that such a thing is really not self-interest. It's not rational self-interest. It's irrational, contradictory, self-defeating self-interest. It really shouldn't even be thought of as self-interest. The notion that you serve your self-interest through robbery and plunder, when generalized, is entirely self-defeating. And it's self-defeating in another respect, too. Suppose we have people who believe that the way they can serve their self-interest, if they could get away with it, is through robbery. They believe that that's how they could serve their self-interest if they could get away with it. Now, that becomes the general attitude in a society, that the way self-interest can be achieved is through robbery. Even if each individual thinks, well, it's okay for me to steal if I can get away with it. I won't tell anyone that I think that, but if I can get away with it, that'll be good for me. What attitude would you expect to exist toward the pursuit of self-interest by anybody else? Suppose we have someone who believes that the way you serve your self-interest is through robbery, and you reserve the right to rob to yourself. You say, I'll rob because that's to my self-interest. I won't announce that. And what I'll tell the world is, I would never dream of serving my self-interest. I'm a doormat for the rest of mankind to walk on. I wish to serve everybody. That's my goal. But secretly, I reserve the right to commit robbery. If people believe that, what will be their attitude toward the pursuit of self-interest by everybody else? Well, if you think that self-interest means you rob to serve it, even if you reserve it to yourself, do you want anyone else to do it? No. Now imagine we have a society, all of the members of which believe the way you serve your self-interest is through robbery. What do you think will be the extent to which self-interest can be openly, publicly pursued? It would be impossible. Everyone will be saying, I don't want anyone to pursue their self-interest because that's robbery. You'll be killing me. But at the same time, they can believe that that's how they serve their self-interest. Just imagine you have a society comprised mainly of people who think the way you serve your self-interest is through robbing other people. Now, if they're not psychotic, are they going to announce that attitude? Is someone going to say, I think the way I would benefit if I wanted to benefit is by robbing all of you? How often will you find someone who'll say, who'll get up openly and say, I think I'll benefit if I can rob all of you? What would be the attitude they project in public? If they think self-interest means robbery, are they going to present themselves as pro-self-interest? No, because if they're equating self-interest with robbery, you don't want to announce that you're a robber, or could easily be one. So the public attitude towards self-interest will be entirely negative. But what about the private secret attitude? What happens in those moments when you may decide, yeah, I'd like to serve my self-interest? If you think that self-interest means robbery, that the only way you can serve your self-interest is by robbing others, well, what will happen in those moments when you think of serving your self-interest or decide that you really wish to serve your self-interest? You'll be a robber. Now, don't we observe the phenomenon of politicians whose public career is one of selfless service to the good of mankind? And yet they may have a multi-million dollar Swiss bank account. How do you explain that? Why should such a seeming contradiction not be such a surprise? Because they've had the attitude all along, self-interest and robbery are equivalent. That self-interest, that one man's gain is another man's loss. And that's what they believed. But they don't want to appear in public as saying, I'm an enemy of the human race, because they wouldn't get very far. But if they believe that the way you serve your self-interest is through robbery, then what's going to happen if and when they ever decide to serve their self-interest? They'll be robbers. We shouldn't be so surprised. That's what they've thought all along. Only up till now, they've never said they would serve their self-interest. They've always said they want to be a doormat for the rest of the human race. They're selflessly sacrificing themselves for the good of mankind. But their idea all along is that self-interest is robbery. Well, anytime you find someone with a negative, consistently negative view of self-interest, you should stop and ask yourself, what would ever happen if this person should decide to act on his self-interest? He keeps saying he never would, he never does, wouldn't think of it. But anyone who thinks that self-interest, anyone who buys the idea that one man's gain is another man's loss, what is implied if he should ever decide to act for his own gain?
Someone's
going to
lose.
Pardon me?
Someone's going to lose.
Yeah, watch out, because he thinks that the way he needs to serve his self-interest is by committing something against other people. Now, in a society that thinks of self-interest as evil, what you will have is the private, secret, dark pursuit of self-interest by means of force, robbery, and at the same time, the total public condemnation of it. And there'll be virtually little or no open pursuit of self-interest. A society that turns against self-interest in public is a society of secret thieves. All talking about their morality and dedication to self-sacrifice, but they believe that the way you pursue self-interest is through theft, and again and again, there'll be people who act that way. Now, it was perhaps only in the 17th and 18th century that philosophers began to realize that there is a very different, radically different positive dimension of self-interest. Self-interest as a benevolent force, but that means self-interest under freedom. And that's how the philosophers of the Enlightenment understood self-interest. That's how people like Adam Smith understood self-interest. That's how the great tradition of economists understands self-interest. Self-interest with force and fraud off the table. Then there is room for self-interest, but it's by positive, productive means. And that's what generated the wealth of the world. Yes?
Okay. On that thought, like Adam Smith in particular, I remember meeting him when I graduated, and we spent a particular amount of time talking about how he described motivation as the golden hand of capitalism.
Invisible hand.
The invisible hand of capitalism.
Yeah.
Which I remember this very clearly because it was a great point because of your book on secularism.
Yeah.
The interpretation that we discussed very heavily was that invisible hand was actually a Protestant definition of God.
Okay. So you're asking, how does this relate to secularism?
Yeah.
Okay. Adam Smith said, in talking about the benevolent outcome of self-interest, he had a statement, again and again, individuals, by pursuing their self-interest, serve the public good, even though that was no part of their intention. And they serve it better than those who openly avow the public good as being their goal. And he said, it's as though they were led by an invisible hand. Now, that's purely metaphorical. Adam Smith did not really mean that God is sitting up there looking down at the economic system and making things work out this way. That's purely a metaphor. Things work out this way by virtue of the inner logical necessity of the situation. See, look, here we are. Intel wants to raise its profits. If they can't go and point a gun at the heads of chip buyers, how do they get chip buyers to buy more of their chips or pay a premium price for them? They must offer a better chip, right? Now, is it that it's just arbitrary that they offer a better chip, that God makes them offer a better chip? Or are they offering a better chip because that is the logically necessary thing you have to do to get people voluntarily to part with their chip dollars?
Well, I didn't mean a literal translation of it, yeah. But I see underneath all of this ethic.
Yeah,
I see it as a very Protestant ethic, a belief in a certain moral code that underlies everything.
Well, there is a moral code, and it may well be the case that there's a large overlap between this moral code and the convictions of various Protestant denominations. I'm not an authority on that, but I'm quite willing to believe that. But I would say that it's probably more likely the case that the change in philosophy that occurred had a spillover influence on theology. And you can find this phenomenon going on in other parts of the world today. A couple of decades ago, I spent a few days in Singapore, and I was browsing through a bookstore there, and they were making a conscious effort to reinterpret Buddhism in a way to make it consistent with life in the modern world. And so I would imagine you might find Buddhist philosophers coming out with a reinterpretation of the traditional teachings of Buddhism to make it consistent with what you need to do to live in the modern world. You have people doing the same thing here. There are people like Michael Novak, who's a philosopher, a Catholic philosopher, who tries to convert Catholic theologians to be less opposed to free enterprise, to reinterpret different things in the Bible and Catholic theology. So I don't think it's a given in the religion. There's all kinds of historical influences that have worked in different ways in different religions, and I think they move with philosophical currents.
I just always saw capitalism as kind of the economic derivation of what Martin
Luther was doing. Well, I don't know the details of what Luther was doing, but I would say that capitalism indirectly derives very heavily from what St. Thomas Aquinas did. And he, of course, is perhaps the greatest of the Catholic theologians. Thomas Aquinas was responsible for reintroducing the writings of Aristotle into the Western world. And so this is what I discussed under point two, the philosophical foundations of capitalism and economic activity, starting with secularism. If you're going to have any kind of serious economic development, it's necessary that people believe that the material world in which they live has full reality, that it's not some kind of shadow existence. I mean, just think, suppose people took very, very seriously the conviction that our life in this world is simply a period of testing for an infinite afterlife. And the really important thing is the infinite afterlife and what goes on in your 70 years or whatever of life in this world. That's really very secondary. Well, to what extent would you be able to concentrate on improving your life in this world? I don't think you could give it your full heart and mind, at the least. So that's one issue. Aristotle argued that the material world that we perceive through our senses, that this world is fully real, and we can trust its existence. Closely related, acceptance of the principle of causality. Now, suppose you believed that everything proceeds as a miracle. God is deciding from moment to moment what event will happen following whatever other event. Do you think it would be possible to have science in that environment? So you just think for a moment. A scientist is attempting to find the answer, to explain something. He almost never will find it on the first attempt. What is it that keeps a scientist working attempt after attempt after attempt to find the answer to a question? What philosophical presuppositions must be present in order for the activity of science to proceed? That there is a law, that nature has regularity, that nature operates according to cause and effect, and that our minds are capable of grasping such principles. We have to believe that the human brain has the ability to understand regularities that exist out there in nature. Now, if we thought there are no regularities, or if there are, we can't figure out what they are, then could we have science? No. And if we couldn't have science, could we have technology? No. Well, in order to have science and technology, it's necessary to have these philosophical presuppositions that nature operates according to definite regularities and that our minds are capable of grasping them. Well, Aristotle taught both things, and Thomas Aquinas, in reintroducing Aristotle, brought those attitudes back into the Western world. Then also, the acceptance of causality underlies economic activity in other important ways too, such things as the willingness to work hard, the willingness to save and provide for the future. In order for people to work hard and save and provide for the future, they have to have a certain view of themselves in relation to the world. They have to view themselves as causal agents capable of achieving results that they want to achieve. Now, suppose you thought of yourself as utterly helpless, a ship floating upon the waves, and you're bounced back and forth by currents beyond your control. What could you attempt to accomplish? Nothing. Well, in order for people to do such things as work hard, attempt to solve problems, save and provide for the future, they have to view themselves as effective causal agents. And that's a philosophical attitude. Further, point C, acceptance of the power of reason, consequent view of man and the individual as valuable and competent. Now, just think, what is it that distinguishes us from all of the other animal species? The fact that we possess reason. That's why we say we're higher than the dolphins and tuna fish and even cats and dogs. Now, suppose we did not attach much significance to reason. Suppose, and there have been philosophers in history who have said reason is a trap and a snare. It makes things look logical, but in the last analysis, it's all chaos. So suppose we didn't attach any significant positive valuation to reason. What would that imply about our valuation of the status of human beings compared to other species? We wouldn't see much difference. And I think that's actually happened. You find today a widespread attitude. Well, there are blacks and Caucasians and giraffes and snail daughters, and we're all part of the biotic family. They're not seeing anything that unites human beings and elevates them above all other species. The whole animal rights movement, I think, is founded on the idea that reason doesn't represent a profound difference, the presence or absence of reason. Now, if we have a positive view of reason, if we regard reason as reliable, as the means, certain means of knowledge, and Aristotle taught that reason provides knowledge with certitude, that's what Aquinas taught, and that we have the capacity to exercise it, well, that implies an elevated view of human beings, that human beings are regarded as above the lesser species. Now, if further we regard reason as the possession of the individual human being, not the possession of the human race in the abstract, but the possession of each and every individual human being, what kind of attitude does that imply towards the human individual? We'll have a positive, respectful attitude, because reason means, if reason is reliable, it means, and valuable, it means that the individual human being is valuable and competent. He's able, he's above any other species by virtue of his possession of reason, and he's competent to live by virtue of his possession of reason. So he'd have a positive attitude, and this is just one step removed from the recognition of individual rights. The concept of individual rights arose, became powerful in the 18th century, the age of reason. It was a corollary of the recognition of the value and power of reason, and that the individual possessed it. And that's what underlay such things as our Bill of Rights. And also, it's what underlies such things as great entrepreneurship, great efforts of any kind by individuals. So what is it that would enable someone to set out to discover a new world or to revolutionize an industry? What kind of view of human potential is implied? That human beings can succeed on a grand scale. In order for someone like Columbus to set sail, or for someone to revolutionize the means of production in any field, you have to have a pretty elevated view of what it is possible for a human being to accomplish. Suppose instead your attitude was, you don't know if you can even get your next fix. That's the maximum limit of what you're capable of. Well, how much will such people be led to attempt to achieve? Very, very little. Well, everything in the last analysis comes down to the cultural status of reason. It underlies science and technology. You have to know there are laws of nature that we can discover. It underlies our view of man, our recognition of individual rights, and it limits the degree of the undertakings we attempt to carry out. So it's an essential foundation of all aspects of economic development. And so many of our problems, I think, derive from growing philosophical distrust of the power of reason. Now, in the last few minutes, let me turn to the very controversial character of economics and capitalism. I have a discussion in capitalism. Let me see if I can bring it up on screen. Now, this is on the profit motive, but everything else in capitalism is attacked too. Money is commonly condemned as the root of all evil. Competition is the law of the jungle, survival of the fittest, dog eat dog. Economic inequality is thought of as the basis for class warfare. There is virtually no aspect of capitalism that does not come in for tremendous attack. And I'd like to try briefly to indicate the reasons. Economics encounters a lot of difficulty. At one level, and this is point B, economics versus unscientific personal observations. This is something that exists in other sciences too. For example, in physics, there are such phenomena as if you put a stick in water, the stick looks bent. It isn't bent, but it looks bent. If you're looking up at the sky morning to evening, it appears that the sun goes around the earth. It rises in the east and sets in the west. Now, physics and astronomy know that the stick in the water is not bent. It's the appearance is explained by the way light is refracted in water. And the appearance of the movement of the sun around the earth is explained by the rotation of the earth. Okay, now, these are instances where there is some level of conflict between superficial, unscientific observation and the teachings of serious science. And there's a comparable level of difficulty in economics. For example, it may appear that machinery causes unemployment. or that war causes prosperity. I would say these are phenomena of comparable false appearance as the stick in the water, a stick being bent in the water, and the sun revolving around the earth. They can be explained without too great difficulty. Machinery does not cause unemployment. It changes the pattern of employment. War does not promote prosperity. Just changes the pattern of activity. So that's one level of difficulty. Now, in the history of physics and astronomy, they also encountered a further level. When Galileo was explaining that the Earth actually revolves around the Sun rather than the Sun around the Earth, there was a further element beyond naive observation, and that was that Galileo's teaching was perceived as an attack on the whole foundation of theology. Because it was thought God has made man the center, man is his highest creation, the earth, his home, is therefore the center of the universe, and so the sun must revolve around the earth, not the earth around the sun. So when Galileo argued that the earth is revolving around the sun, that was being perceived as an attack on the foundations of received morality. And that made his job much more difficult. He was threatened with torture by the Inquisition. Now, there's something similar in economics. Economics has a very different view of self-interest than we have received from traditional morality. What is the view of self-interest that we obtain from traditional morality? That it's greed, that it's at best it's amoral, more likely it's immoral. There's a very negative view of self-interest, and the positive virtue from traditional morality is supposed to be self-sacrifice. Self-interest is thought to be evil, self-sacrifice good. But if you study economics and you see how markets work and how the economy prospers and functions, you cannot help but arrive at a radically different view of self-interest. Of course, you have to be aware that we're talking about self-interest under freedom, meaning you cannot strive to serve your self-interest through the initiation of force. That's out. We're only talking about the pursuit of self-interest by peaceful, voluntary means. That can't be stressed too strongly. But if you do make that distinction, and you're looking at self-interest under freedom, then you have a view of self-interest that is very, very much at odds with traditional morality. And that perception, I think, has created the greatest difficulties for economics, comparable to Galileo and the Inquisition. It's perceived as more than an issue of the particular science. It's perceived as something with enormous, wider moral, theological implications. But then economics has an even greater difficulty, one which was never experienced by astronomy or physics, and that is its problems are compounded by what I refer to in point D as economics versus irrational self-interest. Namely, there are many, many people who believe that the way to pursue their self-interest is, in fact, by committing robbery and fraud. They think that's how you serve your self-interest. Now, to the extent there are such people, what is the effect on the perception of self-interest? It reinforces the negative perception. To the extent that there are people who believe they can achieve their self-interest through force, and they attempt to do so, that feeds the assumption that self-interest is evil. They appear to be providing fresh evidence for it. It's as though when Galileo presented his ideas, not only would there be this theological opposition that it's undermining the foundations of theology. But imagine that there had been groups of people in Galileo's time who had some kind of positive vested interest in the sun revolving around the earth, in the idea that the sun revolves around the earth. Well, we have something comparable in the economic world. There are people who positively believe that their self-interest is served by the use of force or fraud. And to the extent that there are such people, they confirm or appear to confirm the idea that self-interest is evil and self-sacrifice is the only thing moral. So it is really vital to recognize what kind of self-interest we're talking about. And then finally, there's this last point, economics versus irrationalism. In order to establish its propositions, economics depends on chains of reasoning. People have to be willing to start with premises and follow their logical implications. But what happens if people don't trust the process of logic? Suppose they have the attitude, oh, you can prove anything. What does that mean about your ability to prove anything? And what does it mean about people's willingness to follow chains of thought? Well, to the extent there are such attitudes, that's an added difficulty. Okay, well, let me pause here and see what reaction, if any, I'm getting. Have I misstated anything of significance?
You're not saying greed is good. It's not that Gordon Gekko.
I mean, well,
you're saying self-interest is good.
Self-interest is good, but it would depend on what you mean by greed. If you want to, if by greed one means one wants to serve one's self-interest to the utmost extent, then I would accept the proposition: greed is good. But that's not accepting the character of Gord Gekko. You see, it's all an issue. If you're talking about self-interest through peaceful, voluntary exchange to mutual benefit, well, isn't more of it better than less? Now, the only problem is if people start mixing in the pursuit of self-interest by the initiation of force. Then that is wrong in any quantity. Okay, any further questions or comments? All right, well then, I hope to see you all 2 weeks from tonight. And please, please send me an email with a reliable return email address. Include your home and office phone numbers and the way you want your name to appear on a nameplate. So, see you all in 2 weeks.
Thanks, Professor.
You're very welcome.
Have a good night.
See you later.